stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting the death toll from massive explosions in the Chinese port of Tianjin is now at 104, including 21 firefighters, state media reported today. Chinese authorities have ordered an immediate mandatory evacuation from the site of the massive fire and explosions that devastated an industrial neighborhood in the northeastern port city. Chinese Central Television is reporting rescue operations have been suspended after a fresh fire broke out near the scene. The TV channel said a car slightly damaged during the explosion caught fire. Beijing News is reporting everyone within a 3-kilometer radius of the warehouse explosion site is being forcibly evacuated due to exposure to a possible chemical contamination. Sodium cyanide, a toxic chemical that can be detected, was detected east of the site, according to police cited by the pair. In Iraq, a car bombing today at a popular auto dealership in a Shiite-majority suburb has killed 11 people and wounded at least 35. The blast hit a neighborhood of Sadr City, the same district where a massive truck bomb ripped through a wholesale vegetable market just 2 days ago, killing 67 people. One of the worst attacks in Baghdad in a decade. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility for today's attack. A Syrian rebel group says a ceasefire negotiated with the Syrian army and its Lebanese ally Hezbollah has collapsed and fighting resumed in the strategic northern town of Zabadani and two nearby villages. The 72-hour truce in rebel-held Zabadani near the Lebanese border and the Shiite settlements of Fua and Kafreya, the last two government-held villages in Idlib province, was reached earlier this week and was supposed to last until tomorrow. But the main rebel group involved in the negotiation says they have resumed military operations after the talks failed. Government forces and allies are shelling rebel positions, according to London-based sources. This is VOA News. The Italian Navy says at least 40 migrants are dead and an unknown number of others rescued from what local media are describing as an overcrowded people smugglers boat just off the coast of Libya. A Navy statement on Twitter says the rescue operation is ongoing. German lawmakers are expected to vote Wednesday on whether to approve a third bailout for Greece. Both Greek lawmakers and Eurozone finance ministers now back the deal, but Lisa Brand reports from Paris that hurdles remain.
A number of Eurozone parliaments must vote on it, starting with Germany, one of the biggest bailout skeptics. The European Commission wants parliaments to pass the deal by Wednesday to allow Greece to repay the $3.6 billion it owes the European Central Bank by deadline. Dutch finance minister and Eurogroup head Jeroen Dijsselbloem hailed the agreement at a press conference in Brussels.
It's comprehensive. It addresses the main challenges on reaching sound public finances, but also structural policy frameworks. And it safeguards financial stability.
IMF chief Christine Lagarde said the bailout agreement is an important step forward, but more needs to be done. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Secretary of State John Kerry says a new U.S.-Cuban committee will begin talks next month on full normalization of bilateral ties, building on Friday's historic ceremony in which the American flag was raised above the U.S. embassy in Havana for the first time in more than 54 years. Mr. Kerry spoke at a joint news conference with Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez.
The policies of the past have not led to a democratic transition in Cuba. It would be equally unrealistic to expect normalizing relations to have, in a short term, a transformational impact.
Some U.S. lawmakers oppose normalized relations with Cuba and want to keep a long-standing embargo against Havana. Mr. Kerry and President Obama want it to end. The Iraqi government is promising sweeping reforms to fight corruption, which activists say could help ease the country's security crisis. Heather Murdoch reports.
For weeks, protesters in Iraq sweltered through temperatures, sometimes in the 50s, demanding electricity. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi then promised widespread reforms and began firing high-level officials whom he deemed corrupt. Carnegie Middle East Center scholar Renaud Mansour says anti-corruption reforms could also help Iraq fight Islamic State by centralizing security forces.
This is a way for him to say that we need to begin to institutionalize the security sector away from what's happening now in Iraq, which is the state essentially being at the behest of different paramilitary groups.
The self-proclaimed Islamic State has controlled large portions of Iraq and Syria for over a year, despite a U.S.-led coalition fighting the group. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
And I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Sudan has come out in its leadership to say they will give ammunition to the rebels so that they can make a regime change in the Republic of South Sudan.
South Sudan accuses neighboring Sudan of supporting rebels to forcefully take over power. We'll have details.
We went to elections with not good security, and this is the outcome after elections, that the security has lapsed to this, where we've lost one of the most high-ranking officers.
Former Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane and some opposition leaders flee to South Africa, citing a plot to assassinate them.
A section of the opposition that feel for what was negotiated is much more of a personal deal between Museveni and Uhuru.
And Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta comes under criticisms following a deal with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese Foreign Minister has expressed concern about a report indicating Sudan President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has promised to support rebel leader Riek Machar to forcefully take over power. Barnaba Marielle Benjamin says the administration in Juba plans to raise its concerns to officials in Khartoum as part of an effort to resolve South Sudan's ongoing conflict. Benjamin told me earlier that President Salva Kiir is on standby to head to Ethiopia to sign a peace deal with the rebels once negotiations are complete.
Well, this is a very unfortunate development. If the Republic of Sudan has come out in its leadership to say they will give ammunition to the rebels so that they can make a regime change in the Republic of South Sudan, this is not in the spirit of cooperation between the two countries, nor does it indicate good neighborliness, because to have a neighbor, you need the two countries need to have good relations in as far as the cooperation agreement is concerned. On our side, we have always told Sudan that we need to have our good relations. We need to help each other resolve our various internal challenges in a positive manner that promotes a good neighborhood in our territory. The rebels will not achieve the purpose that they are being supported by all those people who are giving them arms and ammunition.
Dr. Benjamin, will South Sudan officially petition IGAD about this concern?
Definitely, we are in talking terms with the Republic of Sudan. We have got cooperation agreement, which is a platform on which we discuss all issues. And in that platform of cooperation agreement, we had agreed that any differences between the two countries should be resolved peacefully, but not through armament or through fighting. So definitely we will express our concern to them, and we will ask them where this attitude of supporting the rebels, which we have been saying along that they should not do that, I think it is, will definitely express our concerns indeed.
We also heard reports of an issued statement from IGAD saying they want all parties to be present, the principal parties to be present, to sign a deadline deal by August 17th. Is South Sudan committed to this directive?
We are committed to peace, but what is required, you must sign a deal that you have agreed. We have already, people are negotiating now. We have got our chief negotiator on the spot. Our chief negotiator will send us a signal that all has been agreed. Our president cannot go and negotiate. We have got a big delegation led by chief negotiator Honorable Nyan, who have been empowered not only by the president but by the whole leadership of the Republic of South Sudan that they should conclude the peace process, and our president will come to sign if they have finished and concluded the peace process, because the so-called compromise proposal, those are proposals. They need to be negotiated on, because there are a lot of issues, points in it, which need to be corrected. So our president is on the standby. If they have concluded and they have agreed that a peace deal is now ready, definitely our president will be going. But in the meantime, our president has sent ahead his vice president, Honorable Wani Iga, in order to go in his place. He's not going there to negotiate. He's going there to sign, isn't it? And people are negotiating. They haven't yet finished. So how would he go? He didn't say that he will not sign, but he needs to sign a peace agreement that is comprehensive, that has been agreed by both sides. But you must know, Peter, also the rebels now are actually split. All the generals in the field, including the political leadership, are saying that Riek Machar is no longer their leader. They have disowned him. So we are now going negotiating with Riek. We are also obliged to negotiate with the people who have a split, who are actually fighting in the field. So Riek is in Addis. He has no army on the ground.
So does that mean that the August 17 deadline issued by IGAD will not be met?
The issue is not the deadline. The issue is the peace agreement. It is a process. Peace is a process. Now, if they agree, even if they were to agree today, our president will be there tomorrow to sign, not necessarily the 17th. But if there is no peace agreement that had been negotiated and agreed upon, then what are you going to sign? So you don't put the date. You put whether the peace process has moved forward. If the peace process has moved forward and there are still issues to be discussed and dialogued on, then you must give that opportunity, because what you want is not just signing. It's not the date. 17 is not a football match, you know, that it is 90 minutes and the game is over. This is a peace process being negotiated. Now, if our delegation sends a signal that they have finished everything, definitely our president will be there to sign.
Barnaba Maria Benjamin is the foreign minister for South Sudan. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Meanwhile, the rebels have denied receiving military support from Sudan to take over power in Juba. Ezekiel Lol Gatkuoth, chairman of the National Commission for External Relations for the rebels, told me earlier that the accusation is a demonstration of the government tactic to undermine the peace negotiations.
Of course, you know, when you fail, some people would want to blame others for their failures. Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, they have envoys working from day one since December 2013 to bring peace to South Sudan. And that commitment by the three countries, Kenya, Sudan, and Ethiopia, is still there, and they are trying to bring peace to South Sudan. So Barnaba should be focusing on how to bring peace instead of accusing a friendly neighbor who is actually committed to bring peace to South Sudan. So for me, he should be focusing on how us as SPLM, SPLA, and then the government, how can we bridge our differences and bring peace to South Sudan as soon as possible.
Are you therefore denying that Sudan is providing you with arms and ammunition in your effort, in your rebellion to overtake government or to overtake South Sudan and seize power militarily?
You know, from the beginning, there was no intention of even fighting from our side. We were raising reforms democratically. It was Salva who introduced this violence to all of us. Sudan has nothing to do with this. We are not getting any arms from Sudan. We are getting what we are getting from Salva. He's actually buying it for all of us. And then when we are fighting, we supply ourselves from what we get from the field. This is actually to answer your question. But the focus should be bringing peace and stability to South Sudan.
The IGAD Troika issued a statement today saying they expect all parties to be present to negotiate so a final peace deal will be signed on the deadline of August 17. What is your part, in this case, Dr. Riek Machar, your leader, doing about this? Because it appears all the parties are not there.
Well, it is actually the contrary. We are here, myself and my leader, Dr. Riek Machar. We were in South Africa, and we have to cut short our trip to be here starting from the 11th of August. They were supposed to meet Salva and Dr. Riek. They were supposed to meet on the 13th and 14th. We have been waiting since August 11th for this meeting to take place. We are here, all of us, we are here. We are waiting for Salva. Salva is not here. And we are actually telling him to come and negotiate with us. so that we bring peace on the 17th of August 2015. We are committed to the date, and we are committed to bringing peace to the people of South Sudan based on the IGAD Plus draft compromise agreement. We are not happy with the document. It is a very bad document for us, but this is actually the only document that we can use as a basis for negotiation with SALFA so that we can compromise.
Are you committed to ensuring that a peace deal is signed and all fighting or the conflict will end by 17th of August as stipulated by regional forces backed by the international community?
Yes, because we are here, we are ready to negotiate with SALFA. If he's here today, today is the 15th of August, we have 2 days left. We are ready to negotiate with him to bring peace on the 17th of August. And my leader, Dr. Riek Machar, is here waiting for him. Our negotiating team is here since the 6th of August, negotiating with the team of SALFA, but there are no progress. The issues that are actually left, the 5 issues that are left to be discussed by the principal, the issue of federalism, the issue of security arrangement, the issue of accountability, the issue of power sharing in the national and also state and local level are still left to be discussed by the leaders so that we can actually have a breakthrough on the 17th of August.
Ezekiel Lol Gatkoth is the chairman of the National Commission for External Relations for the South Sudan Rebels. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Many Zimbabweans have expressed mixed feelings about President Robert Mugabe's achievement as chairman of the Southern African Development Community, SADC. Some say he achieved nothing, and others say he used the opportunity to clean up the country's battered image abroad and in the process reclaimed his status as a legitimate African statesman. For VOA, Ivan Chifera reports from the capital, Harare.
Leader of the country's main opposition movement for Democratic Change Party and former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai says the 91-year-old president had not achieved anything significant as Zimbabwe itself was facing a crisis.
President Mugabe's legacy as chairman of AU and chairman of SADC has not achieved any significant imprint in SADC or in the AU because of the crisis of Zimbabwe. The crisis of Zimbabwe, as I said, is a crisis of legitimate, a crisis of governance. You can't be a leader of these organizations when the first accusation is that you have to put your house in order first.
Tsvangirai predicts that Zimbabwe will be brought back on the regional bloc's agenda once Mr. Mugabe relinquishes the chairmanship next week.
What it means is that SADC must be able to say, look, we have a situation in Zimbabwe in which the regime is unstable. It's imploding. You have a situation where the economy is imploding. We have a situation where the government and the potential of Zimbabwe is being wasted because it is isolated internationally. So you have 3 issues that are of concern to SADC that they need to address. So it's unavoidable to bring back, even after the relinquishing of his chairmanship, to bring back the Zimbabwean crisis in the SADC debate because it affects everyone.
Terence Chimavi, director for the Organization for Zimbabwe Trust, tells Studio 7 Mr. Mugabe's chairmanship of SADC and the African Union had been blighted by Zimbabwe's own economic and social problems, leading to Mr. Mugabe's failure to deal with regional and continental problems.
We really didn't see SADC doing much. Maybe they did behind the scenes, but as a body, they didn't speak much to those issues.
Besides Zimbabwe and Mr. Mugabe's shortcomings, the chairmanship of SADC or the AU are largely ceremonial, hence not much is expected from whichever president will be chairing the two organizations. Political commentator Takura Jangaja concurs, saying even Botswana President Ian Khama, who is taking over from Mr. Mugabe, is likely not to have any impact. Jangaja, however, to some extent, disagrees with Tsvangirai and Chimavi, saying Mr. Mugabe's chairing of SADC had in fact somehow normalized Zimbabwe as a country after years of crisis.
So the main benefit is that we became a normal country. And therefore in the region we became to somewhat be respected as a normal country with a normal leadership. That's the only benefit. But materially, there is no other benefit that we got from chairing SADC. You don't do anything spectacular as SADC chairman, because SADC is run by consensus.
He, however, adds, because Zimbabwe itself was coming out of a crisis, Mr. Mugabe was unable to play any effective role in the Lesotho and Madagascar crises.
Beyond that, we're never going to exert any influence in the region because, A, we are no longer a regional superpower or a power. We no longer call the shots because we were a crisis country. So they got to mediate in our situation.
But University of Zimbabwe lecturer Professor Charity Manyurge differs, as she believes President Robert Mugabe had played a crucial role in resolving both crises and cooling down temperatures during the xenophobic attacks on foreigners in South Africa.
President Mugabe helped calm down because many said, you know, he'd been angered, but it was about conflict management, far excellence, which was done by the chairman. You know, as a people, we want to be able to move without any visas, without any occurs.
Zhangasha says it's unlikely the barriers will be removed, saying some countries in the region, like Zimbabwe, are pursuing policies that are not in line with regional best practices. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Lesotho's former Prime Minister Thomas Thabane and parliamentarian Thesele Maserebani, among others, have fled to neighboring South Africa after citing a plot to assassinate them last week. Mr. Thabane held talks with Prime Minister Pakalitha Mosisili in South Africa, where he stated conditions under which he will return home. They include an investigation by the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, into administration charges against him and allegations that he is targeted to be killed. Maserebani told me that Lesotho still faces security difficulties.
At the moment, in Lesotho, SADC has intervened because we had to approach SADC, being the former prime minister, requesting a fact-finding mission to be sent to the country, because, honestly, we went to elections with not good security, and this is the outcome after elections, that the security has lapsed to this, where we've lost one of the most high-ranking officers in the Lesotho Defense Force, Lieutenant Colonel Mahau, who was shot daylight by Lesotho Defense Force members. We are now having a commission led by Judge Pumapi from Botswana in Lesotho as a follow-up on the report of a fact-finding mission.
Officials in Lesotho have said that you should present your proof of you being hounded and that you are just making things up for failing to account for your stewardship, and that is why you running away, and that your life is not in danger. What do you say to that?
There was a hit list that was produced by the Defense Force members that implicated myself and the former Prime Minister and the deceased Mahau. At that time, when I fled, I was advised by Lesotho Defense Force members that I should leave the country because the Lesotho Defense Command is saying I'm part of the planning of the mutiny, and the Lesotho Defense Force members are going to arrest me. I'm a civilian. I am not a member of Defense Force, and I'm a politician. I don't entertain into mutinies or mutiny programs. That is not my program. My program is clear, is to lead a party to elections, to what I've done. My program is clear. I want peace and stability in Lesotho. That was our request when going for elections. So I had to get out of that country.
Mr. Maserebani, we had reports also that the former Prime Minister Thabane met with the current Prime Minister Mosisili in order to smoothen things out for his return. He outlined some conditions under which he will return. Were you giving assurances of protection if you were to return to Lesotho by the Prime Minister?
The former Prime Minister gave me a report after coming from the meeting that he was being offered a house, which is part of his package as a retired Prime Minister or as a former Prime Minister. He has been offered security, and he has given out a condition that he cannot go back while Commander Kamud is still the Lesotho Defense Force commander. That was his report when he told me. But on my side, I'm very clear. I cannot go to Lesotho while a criminal, an international criminal, on top of that, is a commander of Lesotho Defense Force. That is the condition. And SADC has to deal with it. I'm not running away for saying I cannot go to court if I'm being summoned for any criminality or any act of criminal. I'll go to court in Lesotho. I'm still a Lesotho citizen. I haven't applied for a political asylum. I'm still a leader of the Lesotho National Party, a member of parliament.
Thesele Maseribane is a member of parliament from Lesotho. He spoke with me from South Africa. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is facing intense criticism for the trade deals signed during his recent visit to neighboring Uganda. On his first state visit to Uganda last week, Kenyatta and his host President Yoweri Museveni announced measures related to the economic cooperation between their two countries. The two leaders also announced a new trade pact which ends a ban on Ugandan sugar imports in Kenya and allows Kenya to export beef and dairy products to Uganda. David Ohito is digital editor at the Standard Media Group in Kenya. Reporter Douglas Impuga reached him in Nairobi to find out the reaction of the people.
There have been two sets of reaction. One from the Kenyan government wing, which claims they went to boost trade between Kenya and its biggest partner, which is Uganda, and to improve the relations, faster movement of goods, and to eliminate barriers that have slowed down trade. Two is the reaction from a section of the opposition that feel what was negotiated is much more of a personal deal between Museveni and Uhuru, and which really do not impact the people. And if they do so, they impact people negatively, because the sugar matter and importation has been a very controversial subject in Kenya. The opposition has been raising a lot of heat, especially the western part of Kenya, which grows sugar cane and has about 10 sugar mills, and will be affected seriously should cheap imports come from Uganda. But there's also the question that does Uganda really have enough sugar to export to Kenya? So they are seeing a thin line between cartels who import cheap sugar from other parts of the world, including Southern America, and then they route it to Uganda and then back to Kenya, claiming it has been milled in Uganda and sold to Kenya.
Kenyan cane farmers under the Kenya National Federation of Sugar Cane Farmers have also raised concern about the deal, especially on sugar. How serious are their concerns?
Very, very serious. And coming at a time when the country's biggest miller, Mumias Sugar, is really struggling, and the other state partially owned mills, which government has shares in, like Sony, Chemelil, are equally struggling. And there are nearly about 800,000 farmers who will be directly affected by these imports across the country. And in terms of jobs, we're talking about in excess of 20,000 jobs directly for people who work in the factory mills and people who do subsidiary works in parts of companies also. So the impact is massive, and it's the biggest economic activity in Western Kenya and parts of Nyanza.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga has challenged President Kenyatta to make public the deals he signed with his Ugandan counterpart, Yoweri Museveni, to allow for the public to judge their worthiness. Do you think President Uhuru will take up that challenge?
There have been conflicting statements from the government itself. The leader of government business says deals were signed. The principal secretary and minister of agriculture and the cabinet secretary for trade say no deal was signed. So in public interest, because these are public officials and he used public coffers to do his trip to Uganda, yes, I think the opposition have a case and a genuine one to put to public the information of what deals they discussed. We know there are very vested political interests in the dairy industry, with very senior government officials owning very big percentages of the dairy industry in Kenya. So whether this was a personal deal or a government-to-government deal needs to come out very clearly so that we eliminate suspicion and bad-mouthing each other.
So in your opinion, what should the Kenyan government do?
I think in this era, the Constitution of Kenya expressly says the public have a right to information. The government itself, being a so-called digital government, should publish the details of this trip and if there are any trade agreements so that people who are in the know, farmers are in the know, and we eliminate suspicion and we can continue with good relations with our sister country, Uganda.
David Ohito is the digital editor at the Standard Media Group. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
You want me? love is blind, but I dare see her for your eyes.
Oh,
I saw and I saw and I saw. Keep studying. G-O-Y. Yeah. No, be you a carry come. When are you a go carry go? Sissy, I'm carry go. Yeah, yo. No, be you a de check on no. When are you a wanna know? No, 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 no. Sissy, Ferrari, yo.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This combination of different understanding of what is going on across the Atlantic Ocean with regard to U.S. policy in Africa is a very interesting development every moment. At this particular moment in time, Americans are very much preoccupied with the next presidential elections. And those who are looking at U.S. policy in Africa will pay close attention to what has been done by Americans in Africa during the last 7+ many months of President Obama. There are three things I want to focus on this week in light of what is being reported on this side of the Atlantic and what is being debated on the other side of the world in Africa. One is U.S. policy and health in Africa. What some of the scientific journals in the United States and elsewhere in the world are talking about is a new day in Africa. The new day in Africa, because most of the time the media has not been very fair to reports out of Africa or reports going to Africa. And that is why health in Africa is becoming very important news item. The good side of reporting about Africa. And I'm sure the Voice of America is a very good vehicle to carry this information back to the Africans. And that is polio. Polio. Polio, stupid. Polio, 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 stupid. Polio has been a problem, not only in Africa, but in many parts of the world, particularly in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other parts of Asia, or even Latin America. Africa has some issues in U.S. policy because the United States tried to be involved in some parts of Africa more recent times Nigeria and Chad. And of course, this is how U.S. policy, health, and religious politics sometimes conflict. And most people who have been looking at Americans and other parts of the West trying to do good in Africa, we have many NGOs from the West, and particularly from the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, try to add some American weight in health. So polio was a big issue. Now the World Health Organization and the scientific journals are saying polio is on the retreat. And this is one good point that the Obama legacy could take advantage of. If between now and the end of Obama, we don't have any deadly report about polio around Africa. So this will very well go to the legacy of Obama. Of course, the credit is not only Obama. It can be traced back to Bush and to Clinton and even Jimmy Carter and others who have been concerned about what can America do to help the Africans. You can find evidence in this if you look at scholarly and journalistic reports over the last 30, 40 years with regard to polio. More recently, the second issue is Ebola. Ebola came out of Congo. And interestingly enough, during the Cold War, Ebola was not really dramatized worldwide. And of course, the American media could be cited by some elements in Africa who may be anti-American, was saying that when Mobutu was running the Congo, or DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, as it is now called, Ebola was not celebrated or talked about negatively as it was in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and others. And in fact, from a U.S. foreign policy point of view, Ebola really created havoc when Africa's greatest moment for Obama was to bring all the African leaders to Washington. And Ebola was the big disease that really created havoc. And today, anyone who is looking at U.S. policy and health in Africa, there is definitely going to be a chapter on Ebola and U.S. policy. And the transfer of large number of American resources and personnel to put an end to Ebola. So when you talk about American foreign policy and diseases in Africa, you have a very interesting story with regard to polio, Ebola, and now finally the type disease, which comes into question with regard to U.S. policy in Africa, and that is malaria. Malaria has a longer story with regard to relationship between the United States and Africa. American missionaries who went to Liberia and other parts of Africa, as far as Congo, South Africa, had to deal with malaria. There is a body of knowledge with regard to malaria, America, and African health. Those who are in health have much to speak about this. To round the whole narrative up, we talk about President Obama, health, and the African condition. Anyone who is going to look at the presidency of President Obama with regard to legacy will see to what extent one can compare Bill Clinton health and Africa, Bush health and Africa, and now most recently you can talk about President Obama and health in Africa. So in conclusion, what I would say to the audience and those who are blogging, that this is an important moment for us to really see how can the African governments and President Obama come together next time around before he leaves office. They are going to meet here again. This becomes a very important item. And I will say that's the way it is today when we talk about Ebola, polio, and malaria and U.S. policy in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how powerful a man is, he cannot make the rains fall only on his farm. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Well, the outbreak of Ebola virus disease that killed more than 11,280 people in West Africa has trailed off considerably, it is not yet over. Only 5 new cases were reported in the 2 weeks ending August 9th, 2 in Sierra Leone and 3 in Guinea. This is the lowest number of new cases reported since March 2014 and down from a long period during 2015 when there were 20 to 30 new cases each week. Without a doubt, the reason we have seen such results is because we stood as a united front in combating the disease, said USAID Acting Administrator Alfonso Lenhart at a July 10th UN International Ebola Recovery Conference. The epidemic may be waning, but its effects ripple far beyond the disease itself. Young people stopped going to school, and trade declined as countries closed their borders, said Acting Administrator Lenhart. The outbreak stretched the limits of entire institutions, from health ministries to infrastructure, that must now be rebuilt. Getting to zero, no new cases, will require continued follow-up from governments, donors, international aid groups, and NGOs. The systems that have been built to detect, track, and treat Ebola must not be dismantled prematurely. As the scope of the Ebola epidemic grew during 2014, the United States stepped up to help, so far providing nearly $2 billion for response efforts, including funding and training for thousands of healthcare workers, construction of 15 Ebola treatment units in Liberia, delivery of equipment and medicines, and provisions of laboratories. Now, to help with their recovery, the U.S. government will provide an additional $266 million. These funds will help Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea fix critical gaps in their health care and emergency response systems, as well as schools, water and food supply, and other sectors damaged by the Ebola crisis. As we continue on the road to zero cases, the United States is here to support the people of West Africa as they begin the long process of rebuilding and restoring their livelihoods and personal development, said Acting Administrator Lenhart. The United States remains committed to supporting our partners in each country as they transition from crisis to recovery.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.